It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Mark Maron is a comedian, and at a point when things weren't going particularly well in his life, he started a podcast recorded in his garage. He called it WTF. The podcast took off. It's become a must-listen for people all over the place. He started out featuring his fellow comedians, but now celebrities from every walk of life have been in that garage, including the President of the United States. He also has a television show on IFC called Maron. The fourth season premieres this spring. He'll be in Iowa City for the Mission Creek Festival on Friday at the Englert Theater at 7 p.m., and he is here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, my pleasure. And how's the weather there?
You know, it's actually lovely. Chilly, but okay. We'll try to make it even nicer by Friday.
Oh, I don't mind chili.
All right. So I want to go back to when you started your podcast. I know it was at kind of a dark time in your life. What was the kernel of an idea that turned into WTF?
Well, it was really just a matter of, desperation. The idea was just a format idea. You know, I'd been fired for the third or fourth time from a job at Air America, and we were in the studios. I was doing a streaming video show for that media outlet, and my producer, Brendan McDonald, and myself had been shut down because of money, and being good liberals, they let us stay in our office throughout the month of the existing month of the contract, so we just started to kind of break into the studios to start doing the podcast. I knew people were doing podcasts. I knew the format was out there. It wasn't necessarily popular, but I liked the audio format. So I asked him if he could figure out how to put it up, and he said yes. So we just started doing it, and we committed to really a schedule over format. So we just knew we were going to do Mondays and Thursdays. We weren't sure how the show would evolve. It was a very different show at the beginning.
Well, and I can imagine that it also probably didn't make any money for you at the beginning. When you committed to that schedule twice a week and decided to start playing with it, what was your goal?
Well, I just had to keep working. You know, I had gotten, I was just getting through a divorce, and I didn't really have any, I didn't have any real options. I do stand up, but I was not I was not a ticket seller. I was not a really known quantity or anything. So the expectation was just to keep doing something creative and try to utilize the new medium with the freedom that podcast afforded us. It wasn't, there was no way to monetize it. We weren't thinking about money at all. We just wanted to see if we could build a show.
And now, you had been working for Air America, but when you started this podcast, you made a decision that you didn't want it to be political. Why is that?
Why bother with that? I mean, it's like, why get sucked into that garbage? I mean, you know, to become part of the machinery of punditry is such a waste of life. You know, people are going to, you know, they're going to vote who they want to vote for, and quietly and on their own in the little booth. You just want people to vote. Just go vote, and you'll make a relatively informed decision. I don't need to be part of that dialogue. You know what I mean? It felt like a charade. It felt ridiculous. And, you know, having done it for a couple of years, you know, on the left or right, it becomes very difficult to have your own point of view about things. You just become part of this weird media circus and battle. And to me, it was just diminishing. And I found that I was angry about deeper, actually more existentially relevant things than you know, getting behind clowns who say they're going to do things or not.
Had you had much experience as an interviewer before you started the podcast?
Not really. I'd interviewed a lot of people on Air America in brief. You know, that was a terrestrial radio show, and as you know, you're sort of moving towards breaks, so there was never any real long form interviews. I never really saw what I was doing as interviewing people, and it was really more a conversation. I was in pretty dire straits at the beginning of WTF, and I, you know, I was not mentally well. I was not emotionally well. I was not financially well. So it really became a way for me to kind of, you know, reintegrate myself into the world and into my community of comedians. And yeah, I really think that if you listen to the first 100 episodes, it's me inviting, you know, relatively famous people to my house to help me with my problems.
When you would invite those relatively famous people to your house, did you have a plan when somebody came into the garage? Or did you just sit down and start rolling?
I generally just roll. You know, I do, you know, I don't want to overlook people's accomplishments. And I do want to have a sense of who they are, at least who I think they are. But I prefer to sort of like, if I outline something, it's never questions. It's just areas of interest that maybe I can get them to, maybe I won't. You know, like, except with the president, that required some diligence. You know, I can do the research, but I find that, you know, people anticipating questions or interviewers anticipating asking them is very specific. It's kind of stilted and it stops and starts. You know, to really create a conversation that keeps moving is very compelling to me when I'm in it, and I think it's also compelling to the listener.
Well, I can imagine when you started talking to your comedian friends, and they were probably, a lot of them were really used to that kind of live performance, to riffing, to improvising. So when you brought them in, did you find that they were ready for that?
No, I mean, because I don't know that we do that. I think that's something that you might do on morning radio, where you go in and you want to engage with a morning crew and do your bits and you know, get some laughs. I really think that it wasn't. I don't find that many people, you know, improvise or riff. I find that, you know, that you want to engage, you know, in a conversation. So, you know, there has to be some mutual interest in that, and generating that mutual interest and you know, and listening to people is where that happens. You know, any comic can sort of do morning radio style riffing, but that's, I don't really do that here. And generally when comics are going to go into a bit, because they know the structure of the show, they go like, well, I do this on stage, or, you know, I mean, I've done this before, but I'll tell you, you know, that kind of stuff.
Is there a point in doing the podcast? I mean, obviously it really started to take off and grow. Your conversation with Louis C.K. is iconic. Was there a point before that when you sort of had an epiphany and thought, wow, this is really working for me?
Yeah, I mean, well, for me, it was always really working. You know, you just didn't know how anyone was going to receive it or whether it was going to sort of, you know, I didn't really have any expectations, but I knew that I enjoyed talking to people. And I always get very nervous and, you know, full of dread before I talk to people, and I don't know really what's going to happen or where it's going to go. And, you know, I have a lot of anxiety as a person. So when I get someone in here in the garage, you know, I engage and I get out of myself, and it's always very, just on a human level, it's very healthy for me, and it's always very compelling. Very rarely do I feel like it wasn't good, if not great. So I there was a lot of instances where I was connecting with people in ways that I thought were very emotionally satisfying and interesting, you know, before Louis. I mean, you know, that Louis thing was, who the hell knew how that was going to go? I mean, you know, I was in New York. We weren't really talking that much, and I think he thought he was kind of doing me a favor because I was in trouble. And, you know, we just sat in his apartment, you know, for 2 hours and had it out like that. I don't think either of us really had any expectation or knew what would come out of that. I just had mics on a fairly, I think the mic sort of compelled me to stay in it emotionally and deal with what we had to deal with. But I wasn't sitting there thinking like, oh, this is going to be a great podcast. Like the best thing that can happen is that you sort of forget you're on the mics. And obviously I've done close to 700 of these. So, you know, I do have a good sense of how a conversation is going or, you know, when to shut up and when not to shut up and all that stuff. But, you know, you're just really hoping for some authentic engagement and to answer the question. You know, I think that's happened, you know, pretty much since I started doing the one-on-one interviews.
Having a microphone in front of your face changes the dynamic of a conversation inevitably. But it also, at least my feeling, is that it gives me a kind of license to ask questions that would be hard to ask if I didn't have that microphone. How do you feel about that? Is that something that frees you up?
You know, I just need people to sort of keep talking. You know, like when you're in the garage, I mean, you're surrounded by books and clutter, and there's a lot of things in here. It's a very sort of like, if this is, you know, your style of cozy, it's certainly a lived-in environment. It does not in any real way feel like a studio. I've put some acoustic foam on the walls, which looks kind of ridiculous. I'm not even sure it does anything, but, you know, some guy gave it to me when I started the thing, and then I just replaced it. So, like, the environment is different. And for people in here, I can't tell you how many times with professional people I got to tell them to get on the mic, you know, to stop moving away from the mic. So there is an element where the best thing that can happen in here that I think does happen is they, you know, people do forget they're on mic. But for me, it gives me license, but I'm still not thinking about that. You know, if I'm really sitting on a question where I'm like, oh God, you know, I'm going to have to do this, and, you know, I can because that's the situation, I try to get it out of the way pretty quickly, and it doesn't happen too often. You know, I sort of feel it out as I'm going. And also, like, the risk of, you know, I'm pretty, you know, I'm not out to sandbag anybody, and I'm not out, you know, if we do something delicate or something, you know, that could be potentially dangerous to somebody, and we have a conversation about it, you know, if somebody wants it taken out, we'll take it out. We'll even take it out if we think it's not safe. So, like, the menace of asking that question is a little tempered by the fact that, you know, we have time afterwards to process it. It's not live radio, you know.
Marc Maron has the number one podcast in the nation. He also has a show on IFC. The second season of Maron will be premiering next month, and he will be performing as part of the Mission Creek Festival Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Then later on this hour, an alternative plan for the Iowa State Historical Society and Museum. I'll be talking with Senator Matt McCoy. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me is comedian Marc Maron. He is the host of the podcast WTF. He also has a television show on the Independent Film Channel called Maron. The fourth season premieres in May. He'll be in Iowa City for the Mission Creek Festival on Friday at 7 p.m. at the Englert Theater. And Marc, before the break, we were talking about interviewing people for WTF and your approach to that. You make yourself very emotionally available and vulnerable in the interviews that you do with people. And, you know, listening to you talk about the early days of the podcast, it sounds like that was something that really grew organically. But as someone who listens, I think it has an incredible amount of power, because if you are that emotionally available, then your guests become that emotionally available too. Have you thought about what that does for the person on the other side of the mic?
No. I mean, I guess I do. I mean, I hear that from people. I hear that assessment of what I do. I feel like I should be funnier during this interview. I mean, we're plugging a comedy show. Do you want me to be funnier? I can turn on the juice. I know how to do that. I can just lock into some goofy stuff right now.
You know, I'm having a good time, so...
Is the sound quality okay on your side?
Yeah, sounds all right.
Okay. I'm hearing, like, buzzy weirdness on this phone. I have this dumb old phone in here that, like, I got at Radio Shack. I didn't even know phones like this exist anymore, but they do. Anyway, so, vulnerability. Like, I think really the only time I am emotionally open these days in my life, that, you know, whatever I've evolved into as a grown person with my own, chronic state of emotional difficulty is, you know, these seem to be the most emotionally available exchanges I have in my life are with these guests and also on stage as a stand-up. I don't know why that is. It's not necessarily the safest thing or the smartest thing, but it just seems to be how I landed after everything I've been through. I can understand on some level why being emotionally available for somebody in my garage who's going to leave in an hour is a fairly safe relationship to take those kind of risks. On stage, I don't always know, you know, why that is, but I think it makes for something very very real to can happen in that zone where you're not running off a paper full of questions. You're not necessarily adhering to material you prepared. I find that, you know, those type of moments in life, if they happen, generally go unappreciated. I think most people are so caught up in whatever patterns of their life that they've established, you know, how they wake up, when they check their phone, how they engage with the people in their lives, you know, where they go for work, what they're going to eat. I think that, you know, because of the way culture is sort of settled right now into this technologically interfaced, you know, kind of emotionally misdirected world that we all live in, that, you know, real moments of emotion and excitement and genuine interaction are so rare. It's sad that that's the case, but that's the case. So where I find it, that it happens, is with these generally strangers in my garage, who many people know from movies or comedy or whatever, or, you know, on stage in front of a room full of strangers. But I guess that, you know, my timing is right on doing that kind of thing. But it was never a plan. I don't think about it. When I read people's, you know, either, you know, criticism or assessment of what I do, I'm always sort of like, oh yeah, I do that. I wish I'd thought of that. So I'm happy when people assess me in a way that not only is favorable, but that I can actually go like, oh, interesting. That is what I do. Now I know that.
Do people come to you now and say, hey, Mark, I want to be on your podcast?
Yeah, sure.
Has that changed the dynamic from the time when you said had to go to people and say, hey, I have a podcast. Would you like to be on it?
No, I still got to do that. You know, see, there's people that are still difficult to get. You know, there are, you know, creative people that, you know, don't really want to do this or don't necessarily consider it something, you know, they need to do, and there's still plenty of people that I have to say, do you want to do it? And they're, you know, it's not like people are, you know, banging down the doors or anything, but, you know, after the first couple hundred, I'd kind of depleted my 6 degrees of separation from people that I could self-book. So, you know, we're in a situation now where we do work with bookers sometimes, and they present people, they pitch people, because a lot of times people are only available when they're doing press for something else, and then we have to sort of, you know, if they don't know the show, we have to tell them, well, we don't do those kind of interviews. We can maybe time it so it coincides with what they're promoting, but, you know, we're going to do an hour sit down and, you know, try to pay a little attention to what they're promoting, but it's going to be a career spanning talk. So a lot of times it's about opportunities, you know, because people don't spend their life running around doing media. Well, that's not true. They do, actually, but not famous people all the time.
So, but the president, his people approached you, right?
Yeah, they did. They approached us, you know, about a year or so before that happened. There was some interest there. There were some staffers that thought it would be, as they say, a good look for the president to maybe do something like WTF. And, you know, we kind of thought that, thank you. That's very flattering. We appreciate your interest. And, you know, we'd hang up and be like, that's never going to happen. How is that possible? How would that happen? And then they sort of kept in touch every few months, and, you know, it was like, yeah, I think we can make this happen. And I was like, yeah, sure, okay. Yeah, I wasn't talking to them, thank God. You know, my business partner and producer, Brendan McDonald, was. And then it, like, came down to the, you know, a few months before where they're like, yeah, we're scheduling it. And he calls me, and I'm like, well, that's crazy. What am I going to go to the White House? And Brendan said, no, he wants to come to the garage. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. The president's just going to come over to my house? That's crazy. And it happened, you know. It was not a casual visit. I mean, it seemed casual. The conversation was casual, but when the president drops by your house, it's not a surprise.
No. I would guess that there's a couple of visits that happen even before he stops.
Oh, yeah,
by.
You got to ask. I had to ask my neighbor if we could put snipers on his roof. You know, I had a and the Secret Service had to come over and scout things out and install some the eeriest thing was, like, I was on vacation the week before he came, and, you know, when I got home, the Secret Service had installed these isolated phone lines in my second bedroom. There's these two black boxes that, you know, if the world's communication system, you know, fell fell apart, he could still be contacted.
Wow.
Weird humming boxes.
Right. They didn't let you keep those, though, did they?
No, they were kind of large things, and it was just so ominous because, like, yeah, I hope we don't have to use those, whatever those are.
So, you know, I interview people every day, and there have been a couple of times in my career where I've interviewed somebody that I admire so much that I just really, really, really get freaked out. And I realize you interview people all the time. You sound very relaxed with everybody that you interview. How freaked out were you about interviewing the president?
Well, that was where, you know, doing political talk radio had helped me because, you know, I respect the office and I like this president, but I also know that he's a politician. And I've talked to a lot of politicians and I know how politicians, you know, operate. And you know, granted, he was the president, but on some level, that just makes him like a really good politician. So what I needed to do in my preparation for that was figure out a way for me to honor myself and what I do and get around, you know, that type of talking. Because they all talk a certain way and they all sort of have an agenda. And so that was really the challenge for me. So I was nervous that that wouldn't happen. You know, I wasn't, you know, it was very exciting to see the president, and I had and to see him walking up my driveway and to get in the zone where I could, you know, not completely, you know, freak out. But I didn't feel that freaked out. I felt more comfortable than, you know, in terms of nervousness than I did, say, interviewing Keith Richards, you know. Like, I knew that, you know, it was something we prepared for. There were things we had to cover. There was a tragedy that happened days before. You know, my producer, Brendan, is a spectacular news producer, and that's sort of what he comes from. And so we knew what we were doing. You know, we had an hour. There were things I wanted to ask, but there was a tone I wanted to happen. And I was fortunate in that happened. You know, it did happen. You know, I believe that, you know, that we connected as people, that you heard a very human Barack Obama, and that, you know, he didn't get, you know, too wonky. He didn't get into the weeds. He didn't start, you know, talking points. You know, the questions were designed to sort of stay around that because, you know, no matter what people expect you to ask the president, if you've ever interviewed a politician, if they don't want to answer a question, they will just answer another question, not the one you asked. So I really wanted to sort of stay out of that. Because, you know, again, it wasn't a sandbagging interview. It was meant to be a candid conversation. But the fact that we had to deal with a massive, you know, gun murder, a racially motivated gun murder, a massacre that happened literally, you know, less than 2 days before he came to my house, you know, it really brought that stuff into the present. So the immediacy of the current was addressed very specifically, you know, through, you know, because of a very dark reality, and a couple of the other things that we needed to address were addressed, you know, about Supreme Court decisions in the upcoming week, because we taped it on a Friday. And then I thought, you know, there was some very interesting stuff about fear, about the nature of performance, about the nature of power, you know. So to answer your question, I wasn't that nervous. You know, I was prepared, but the only thing I was scared of was that I would be steamrolled, which is what politicians can do. It's not really his style, but they can all do it.
You are coming to Iowa City to do a comedy show, and you've been doing more stand-up again lately. The podcast has been extraordinarily successful. You have the show on IFC. And many times you've talked about how your comedy, your creativity, comes from fear and panic. Does success interfere with your creative process?
I think that it sort of broadened it. I don't know, you know, like the idea that I, you know, I'm doing more comedy. I always do comedy. You know, this is the weird thing about, you know, the secret life of Marc Maron is that, and I don't mean to refer to myself in the third person. That was weird. I just freaked myself out a little bit. Anyways, I always do comedy. I'm out at the Comedy Store, like, you know, 3-4 nights a week working on stuff. The fear, panic thing, you know, that's always there. I'm always a bit obsessive and a bit anxious. But, you know, I have... Because of success, primarily, you know, not because I'm resting on my laurels, but after working for half my life at something, to have, you know, some success and some cultural relevance, and to have achieved something that's fairly, you know, helpful and exciting and engaging to me, did fill in a bit of the self-esteem that was lacking, because I think ultimately, whether we want to admit it or not, you know, self-esteem, can whatever you're born with insecurity-wise or whatever you were denied as a kid is going to, you know, make you a certain type of crazy. But if you accomplish something, especially something you've sort of set out to do with your life, you feel better about yourself. But that does not mean that all this stuff that is wrong with my brain is not wrong anymore. I'm just a little more confident in it. It doesn't have to completely disable me, at least not, you know, this morning. But, you know, I don't know about tomorrow. So generally, there is not a dire. I'm not in as much as a panic about, you know, money or about, you know, whether or not I'm going to sell tickets or whether or not I'm doing okay. With what I've chosen to do in my life, some of that stuff has settled down. But I still freak out, like, you know, about stupid stuff and about bigger stuff. And, that doesn't seem to go away. But I do find that because I'm more comfortable in my own skin, that performing is a lot more enjoyable. And I think I'm much more open to letting people in and being part of an audience for me now is, you know, in terms of people coming to see me, I like doing it. You know, it was a very contentious relationship for years because I was so filled with fear and anger, and that's sort of gone, and I really embrace being on stage and hope, you know, things happen that have never happened before, and you know, people experience, you know, something that, you know, won't happen again. You know, I just put out an hour special a while ago, and like in December, and I think, you know, some people have seen it. It's not that easy to see. It's called More Later. You can, Epix did it, and you can see it on Hulu and on Amazon, but I would wait till after the show because I'm going to integrate some of that material in because I've been, you know, shooting for 6 months and working on a TV show. You know, there's this idea that, you know, comics can just magically generate hours, but I have been diligently out in the clubs, you know, hopefully, you know, coming up with a bunch of new stuff and a lot of new directions to go when I'm there. So I'm excited about it.
Well, I don't know that there is this idea that comics can magically produce hours. That sounds really daunting to me, but maybe that's just because I don't do what you do. But
well, I think that people look at it in the form of content. You know, when they see something, you know, I don't think they really always realize what it takes to put together, you know, these large pieces of material. Because, like, if you see something on TV and then you see the guy the next night and he does two of the jokes that you saw on TV, you're like, oh, really? That stuff? It's like, dude, that took me a year. It took me a year. A year and a half to put that together. And now, because you've just turned on your computer, now you expect me to magically, you know, come up with an entire new act. We do it. I mean, I put out 5 CDs and a couple specials, and, you know, like, I'm very excited because, like, you know, when I finished, you know, taping the TV show, which is all-consuming, I was only doing stand-up once a week. I'm like, now I got to get back into stand-up. So I've been like, it's like going to the gym, and I've been for the last 3 weeks just out there really working, you know, some new ideas and some new thoughts and, you know, making sure that, you know, I'm in good stage shape for these 3 dates.
Well, and when you're working on the TV show, you said it's all-encompassing. I can imagine that it's hard to shift gears and move from that and think, oh, right, I need to write comedy. How do you create an environment where that starts to happen again?
I do stand-up. I go down to the Comedy Store and I start getting into it. You know, you get up on stage and, you know, you, like, I don't write jokes. Everything has to happen through conversation. Everything that I do has to happen organically, engaged with other people somehow. It's just or engaged with a microphone. So, you know, I've got, you know, stories, I've got areas. Some things start, you know, on the podcast, in the monologues, where I'm thinking out loud, and then I, you know, as I'm doing it, I'm like, oh, that could, you know, I could build that out. And so it's all about thinking out loud and talking. So, you know, I just start going on stage at comedy clubs, primarily the Comedy Store, which is the greatest comedy club. And I just start hammering it out. I start, you know, finding the courage to do the new stuff, not knowing where it's going to go, and, you know, and let it unfold on stage. And starting in May and June, I generally to do long form stuff to build up a new hour for fall. I will take a residency at a small theater here in town called the Steve Allen Theater, and I'll do Tuesdays for 2 months, like for $5. The ticket's a $5 ticket. And I'll just invite my fans to come and sit there and, you know, watch me wallow through ideas and stories and thoughts for 2 hours or an hour and until something starts to come together. That's how I do it. Through conversation, we get the act.
Mark, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Mark Maron will be performing at 7 p.m. on Friday night at the Englert Theater in Iowa City as part of the Mission Creek Festival. Coming up in just a moment, an alternative plan for the Iowa State Historical Society and Museum. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.